thank you so much for the invitation to be here today. I'm honestly honored and I'm humbled to be asked to fill in this role. So I'm honored. I filled the pulpit at Silverwood Mennonite Church for 11 years as a bivocational pastor, and I love this topic of surviving to thrive, because I felt like what my job was as a pastor was I wanted to help people grow into the life that Jesus wanted them to live, to really thrive and be able to experience the kingdom of God now. That's what I was about as a pastor, and I felt like this topic was really connecting with that. I'm humbled to be talking about this, though, because 2 years ago, I stepped down from ministry and went into business full-time with the business that I'd started, or was part of starting when I was a pastor. And, you know, when I was a pastor and talking to these other business leaders, I had all these great big ideas about how they should be doing things and, like, all this fantastic energy. And I took over in more leadership role in the business when I stepped down. And it seems like right after that, things started changing at the business. And to be honest, it's been a little bit of a struggle over the last couple of years in our business. Market have been changing. Prices have been coming down for the industry that I'm in. Other recyclers have been going out of business right and left. We're still here. We're still surviving. But the thing is, all the big ideas that I had and like to talk about, I feel like I'm actually failing at trying to implement, because all I can try to do is focus on the bottom line, make sure that we're here next month so that we can continue to make paychecks and payroll. And so I'm humbled that you asked me, because it's a little bit daunting to stay here. So I want you all to know that typically when I preach and speak, I'm preaching to myself as much as anybody else, because I need to hear the message about how to focus on the same things I want to talk about. So I'm not here because I got it all figured out. I absolutely don't. What I've learned as a pastor is when I prepare for a speech like this, it's as much about me learning, and then the fact that I have to get up here and present to you, I better know what I'm talking about. And so it's a great opportunity for me to work on myself. So I'm honored, I'm humbled to be here. So thank you so much. To get started, I just want to give you a roadmap of what I want to talk about. The question of this, survive to thrive, I put into the subtitle here as from occupation to vocation. And what to talk about that, I want to just show you, what is a vocation, just to start out? This is what we're going to talk about tonight. In a book that I read by Frederick Buchner, he says this about vocation. Vocation is the place where your deep gladness meets the world's deep need. And if we pay attention to that, there's two pieces of vocation. Your deep gladness has something to do with yourself, and where that meets the world's deep need has something to do with outside of ourselves, out in the world. And when we pull those two together, that's where we find vocation. So we're going to talk about how we serve people out in the world, and we're also going to talk about the other side of the vocation, which has to do with ourselves and what we're bringing into that relationship there as part of our vocation. So now if you know what I'm talking about and you want to go to the dessert reception early, this is your chance. Otherwise, buckle up. Now, I will say, when I was younger, 20 years ago, when I designed my first pastorate in Ohio, I did not really think about vocation like I do today. My thought has changed a lot, thank goodness. And let me give you an example of where I was at back then. So yeah, there was one night, Sunday night, Kidron Mennonite Church in Kidron, Ohio, where we had a planned evening with business leaders. And the title of that night was Called to Business? ? Now, I went to that night with bated breath, because I knew deep down in my deepest, darkest heart of hearts that there was no way that God actually called people to business. Because the real calling, if we were honest, was to be missionary somewhere, doing the Lord's work, or if you weren't up to that task, at least serving a local congregation as a pastor. And the fact that somebody could be involved in the world, in the money-making business, God didn't actually call them to that. And I really wanted to go, because I knew some of the people that were on that panel that night telling their stories had been missionaries in Africa for 10 years. And then they came back to run their family business, and they'd been quite successful. Others had served in other ways, and then they got into business. And I wanted to hear it from the horse's mouth. Did they leave their calling, right? I mean, I wanted to hear him say it. So we went to the night, and they talked, and I wasn't really listening, but I did notice nobody ever actually asked the question, were you called to business? And so at the end of the night, they were getting ready to put the microphone away, and I said, hold up, I got one last question. Are you called to business? I want to know from each and every one of you, can you say yes? And they went down the line and every single one of them said yes. Now I'll be honest, I was judgmental and I shook my head and said, I don't think so. Now, where did I get this idea? I mean, I grew up, my parents talked about church was a priority. I mean, and somehow I pieced this together that if we were Christians, we were all called to ministry. I hadn't yet taken college economics classes that taught me if everybody was a pastor, we'd probably all go hungry. Hadn't really put that together. But it turns out, actually, if we look at church history, I had about 1,000 years of thinking that was actually on my side. You see, around the year 500, there was a guy named Benedict of Nursia. He was the father of the monastic movement. And what he did is he wanted to take his faith seriously. And so he left the world, created a monastic order, wrote a book called The Rule of Saint Benedict on how monks are to live their lives if they are called to this spiritual life. So they took a vow of poverty, they left the economics behind, they left their families, and they moved out and lived this monastic life. And the church caught on to this. And what happened in the Catholic Church for 1,000 years was that they used the word vocation, which is from a Latin root that means calling. The people that had a calling from God were to be monks living the spiritual life or to be priests serving the congregations. Everybody else, we were just the lay people. It didn't matter. Like, we were not the ones that had the higher calling. That was how the church viewed things for over 1,000 years until the Reformation, when a guy named Martin Luther, who started the Reformation that we as Anabaptists grew out of, came along and he said, no. If we are followers of Christ, we are all priesthood. We all are believers, and we have to take that seriously. Martin Luther is the one who generated the coin, the priesthood of all believers. Well, where did he get it? From 1 Peter 2:9, it says, but you are a chosen race, a royal priesthood, a holy nation, God's own people, in order that you may proclaim the mighty acts of him who called you out of darkness into this marvelous light. And what happened is Martin Luther said, look, if we're followers of Jesus, and we all say that we are all priests in the areas that we are. We shouldn't be leaving society like the monks are doing. We actually need to engage society, and we need to be the representation of God in the marketplace, in our jobs, in our families, and in our communities. That's what he challenged and changed with the Catholic Church. And it changed the understanding of calling and started taking it from where it was a two-tiered system to where we were all on equal ground. And the understanding of that word at that point started to have a change. So now the way that I understand vocation is that as a follower of Jesus, when we are baptized, when we make that commitment that we want to be a part of the kingdom of God, what we are saying is, God, I know that you're calling me and I'm going to answer that call. And I am now a part of that holy nation. And what the word holy means is set apart, okay? It means it's something different. Just like when it says you were called out of darkness into this marvelous light, there's obviously a change there, right? So when we answer God's call, and I believe God is calling every single person on this planet to answer the call, when we answer that, that's a part of our vocation, is to be different. We need to be set apart and go about life in a different way. That's a part of our vocation, and that is our calling. So, as we talked about, there's an outward calling, there's an inward calling. I want to start with the outward part, and I want to look at this, because as we're following Jesus, as we're set apart, doing things differently, we have to look at how we serve people around us. And the first thing I want us to consider when we think about our organizations that we work for, it's our interpersonal relationships. Now, I don't want this to just be cliche, right? I mean, obviously we need to be kind to everybody. I know we all have moments, right? I get that. But it's more than that. I want to ask you all a deep question. Do you actually love the people that you work with? See, some of you nodding. Some of you, maybe you're lying. Maybe you're not sure. But do you actually love them? Do you love your customers? Do you love your vendors? Do you love your employees, the people that report to you even when they call off sick for a headache? Do you love them? And I ask this question because if God is the God of love, God is love, what we are about is showing God's love to every single person on this planet. whether they work for us and annoy us or not. Sometimes it's hardest to love the people that we're closest to, that work the closest with, right? I mean, they're the ones that just get under our skin the most. I ask this question because when I was a pastor in Kidron, my uncle was the pastor at the church there. I worked with him. And one of the things he challenged me to in my early days, my first ministry, I was early 20s. He said, Jeremy, I want to challenge you to pray for the people of this congregation that God would give you an unnatural love for them. Because there's going to be people here that are going to grate you. They're going to tell you your preaching was wrong or not interesting enough or boring. And they're going to get under your skin. And how are you going to respond? And he challenged me, if you pray that prayer over and over, said, I believe that the Holy Spirit will give you a love for those people as a part of your congregation that you won't even be able to explain, but they'll know it, they'll feel it, and it will help you in your ministry. I bring that up because it was only in preparing for this talk that I actually thought, do I pray for my employees that I would have a love for them in the same way that I had a love for the congregation that I was leading as a minister? Do I have a love for those customers who were late with their payments? Do I have a love for those vendors who send me material that's not quite what they said it was going to be? Do I love them? I think that's a challenge for all of us because as a royal priesthood, as a representative of God, this is actually what our calling is about. The way that we live that out, it is going to shine through and then affect all of our interactions with every single person if we start with that core of loving them, because they too, no matter how annoying or how late on their payments or whatever's going on, they too are a beloved child of God just like me. And if I can start there, it gives us the opportunity to develop something that is different than they're going to experience with other people who have not answered this calling out in the business world, right? That's one way to look at this, interpersonal relationships. But our businesses and our organizations are more than just how we interact with people. Our businesses and organizations, they have structures, they have systems, they have things that are put into place that, they might seem benign, right? Like it's just company policy. This is the way we have to do it so that we be fair. These are the things that I'm talking about. And so part of our outward calling isn't just on our interpersonal relationships. It actually has to do with the organizations itself and how they're structured and how we operate. And when we look at these things, I think we have to ask a question. Why are we choosing to operate and build our system in this way? What are we measuring against? You see, people in operations love KPIs, key performance indicators, right? Where do you find those? You look for, it's all about performance. How do you gain efficiency? How do you gain better profit for whatever you're doing? How do you find more time, get labor to be more productive? All of that. Oftentimes, you're going to industry trade shows, talking to people who are doing similar things to you and saying, well, how do you guys do it? How are you getting that? And then you start to measure yourself against them and you say, well, what kind of profit margin were you guys having last year? Oh man, I'm a couple points under that. What am I doing wrong? And you start measuring yourself. Well, how much growth did you have? How much whatever? How many employees do you have? So the question is, what are you measuring yourself against? Because if we say that we're followers of Jesus and we're part of the kingdom, we're not part of this world, right? We need to be doing things different. We're set apart because we are different. We've chosen that as a calling to be different than the world. So rather than key performance indicators, the thing that I thought about is getting to kingdom performance indicators. I know that's kind of corny, but I think it will help us a little bit. One example I have about thinking about this. So it was mentioned in the introduction that I serve on a couple of boards. Well, one of the boards that I'm on is a for-profit business. And I'm fortunate enough to be serving in this role that we're paid board members for this organization. It's a decent sized company, a couple hundred employees, almost $400 million in revenue. And I'm also fortunate enough to be on the board committee that sets our board pay. Okay? You all laugh because this is fortunate, right? Well, one of the policies of this company is that our board was going to pay ourselves we wanted to be 90% of the average, between 90% and the average of what peer companies and what we consider to be peer would be the same kind of industry, similar size, and also of similar values to us. We weren't just measuring against just any old other company. And so we wanted to set our pay that would be 90% to the average of this peer group of companies. And so every year our CEO would, he'd talk to the other CEOs in this group of about 12 companies. And he would say, hey, here's what I want to do. Our board's thinking about how we take care of ourselves. What do you guys do? And they all said, yeah, we're willing to share all of our numbers as long as you send us the report too, so that we can see it as well. Well, that seemed more than fair. So we were willing to do that. Well, I started over the years getting a sneaking suspicion that what was happening is that every time everybody got that report, they're like, well, wait a minute, we're on the bottom of the pile this year. We got to pay ourselves more. And so they do. And then they report next year and that number goes up and up and up. And it gets to the point where we're ready to, as a board, to say, we need to give ourselves this year, to stay within policy, a 15% pay raise. And so I asked the CEO, what kind of pay raise is all the other employees getting in the organization? He said, well, on average, it's about 3 or 4% this year. And I said, how can we as the board pay ourselves 15%? We're already, by hourly compensation, the highest compensated employees in the business, because we only have 4 meetings a year, let's be honest. I know we have some very important responsibilities. I'm not trying to belittle that at all. But the point was, why are we doing that? Well, it's because we need to be market competitive, right? If we're going to recruit other board members, we got to be willing to get them. And I said, well, hold up. How many of the people that we're actually going to recruit for our board are going to be getting recruited by these bigger companies? They're not. And if that's what's getting them, they're not the people we want. We want the people who are here because of our mission and our values and what we are about. We don't need to measure ourselves about what the others are doing. We need to measure ourselves about what we think is right, because it's what God is calling us to be: separate, different, a holy nation, set apart, right? I hate tooting my own horn on that, but that was one that I felt pretty good about. I'm not going to lie. And if I'm honest, just to knowing myself, I also knew as I was challenging that, I was only one voice on the board, and so I knew I could like say that and they would still pass it anyway and I'd still get the pay raise. But they didn't. They changed the policy, which I guess was also good. So anyway, the question is, what do we measure ourselves against? It can't just be out there if we're saying that we're different. We have to measure ourselves about the kingdom performance indicators, not just whatever else is market standard, right? So, oh, there was my slide for the board example, right there, the board, so I would remember it. There's a couple of organizations that one in particular that I want to highlight, because it's an organization that I think has done a phenomenal job of doing this differently. How many of you have ever heard of Mondragon in Spain? Have any of you heard of this organization? It's sort of amazing to me that we as Americans have never heard of this company, because if you go home to your kitchen, chances are, I think, greater than 90% that you're within 5 feet of something that this company made, okay? This company was started in the 1950s by a Basque priest in the Basque region of Spain. And what he did is, it was at the time after the Spanish Civil War, unemployment was through the roof, people were really struggling to have any kind of way to take care of themselves. And this priest wanted to do something about it. And so he recruited 4 engineering students from the local school, and they started some sort of a manufacturing company, but they set it up as a cooperative. So it wasn't, I mean, the priest had taken a vow of poverty, right? He still followed the old way. He wasn't part of the Reformation like we are. And so he didn't need the money. And so he set it up as a cooperative where all of the employees would have an ownership stake, that they all would rise and fall together. That little company has now grown to around $11 billion in revenue. They have manufacturing facilities in 37 countries. They do business in about 150 countries around the world. They're an enormous company. They're still a cooperative. They have about 80,000 employees, okay? The things that they do that make them different are the reason that they have survived, and I think the reason that as a business they have continued to thrive. And it's because they don't just look at the bottom line. They look at their people, and they look at labor, and they say that their capital is subordinate to their labor. They make decisions by democracy, not shareholding. So one worker gets one vote, and all of the major decisions of the company are decided collectively across all of their different organizations. Seems like chaos, but somehow they manage it. And as they were growing, one of the things they started to realize is, well, man, if we got all these employees and we're trusting them to make some of these big decisions, they better know what they're talking about, right? So they started saying, like, we got to be training people. So they implemented some educational systems. And before long, they now have part of their cooperative are the university system in Spain, where they train all of their engineers and all the people, their employees coming up. They wanted them to take seriously what was going on. The other thing that they do, they take pay seriously. They want to make sure that we're an equitable and a just system. So in the United States, when we look at big organizations like that, like this, on average, the CEO of a huge company in the United States makes approximately 300 to 400 times what the lowest paid employee makes. Within this organization, they don't set a pay rate, they cap it based on a ratio, that ratio right there. And so if you're a part of this Mondragon Corporation, the CEO's pay rate is capped at 9 times what the lowest paid employee gets. Now, if you think about this, 300 and sometimes, it's the way the world does it, the way the United States do it, to 9 times. What kind of a leader do you think that they're gonna get? The guy that's running an $80,000, or female, I'm not sure, the 80,000 employee, $11 billion company, whose pay is capped at 9 times what the lowest paid employee is, you better believe they're there for a reason, and it's not the money. They're there because they believe in it. And they know that this organization takes care of its people. But more than that, what this organization does is it has a formula for what it does with its profits. It reinvests a certain percentage back in the company. It distributes a certain amount into the retirement accounts of all of the people that are part because they're a cooperative. And then it takes a large chunk and it is used intentionally for the community development of every town that they have a factory or business in. And so not only are they thriving, but the communities that their businesses are in are much better off because they are making a difference. They want to be about something different and better. They're saying, you know what? We've seen all the other businesses. They're still capitalists. They still operate in a capital system just like we do, but they're doing it different. And I guarantee it's because they were started with somebody who said, I know I'm a part of a holy nation. I know I'm set apart and I'm gonna do this based on kingdom principles. And it's about the people and taking care of each other. And they have been wildly successful. I challenge all of you to go find their website and look them up. It's amazing some of the stuff that they're doing. Now, they're not perfect. They're not, you can find some critique. You can find unhappy employees just like with every business. So I know that's out there. That being said, I think it's a great example. Now I understand for a lot of us in small business, you know, these kind of things, like I'd love to do all this stuff and we only have 37 employees. It's not really gonna happen. But the principles are there, right? It's how do we take care of people? How do we make sure that we can operate and trust and empower and coach the people to grow up to become the people that we know God's calling them to be as part of our employees and part of our organizations? If we can invest that way, it's only gonna benefit our organizations as well as the community. More stateside, instead of Mondragon, there's a legal system called Certified B Corporations. I don't know if, have any of you heard of B corporations? Yeah, a couple of you, some of the students. So what a B corporation is in the United States, you can, as an organization, instead of being set up as like an LLC or an S corp or something like that, you can change your legal structure to a B corp in some states. It's not in every single state. When you do this as an organization, what you are doing is you are saying, I am committing to doing my business in a better way. And to participate, you are legally obligated to do environmental studies on your environmental impact. You have to track and report all of your waste generated from all of your systems. You have to do studies on employee engagement. You have to do diversity studies to make sure that wherever your business is, that your employee base somewhat matches the population base of the surrounding area. You have to make sure that you are treating employees in a way where, you know, one of the standards is that every manager has written feedback every so often so that they know exactly what their expectations are frequently. It's a way to do it. And anyway, I just gave that as an example because it's something that's happening in the United States, whereas, you know, Mondragon is based in Spain. So anyway, how we serve those around us. I mean, this is what we have to be thinking about. This is the outside, the external part of our vocation, okay? So, as I said, there's external, but there's also an internal part of the vocation. It's a two-sided, it's two poles that work together. How we serve the world, but it starts with knowing ourselves. One of the books that I read by a guy named Parker Palmer, the lines that just captured me when I was preparing for this, he said, the deepest vocational question is not, what ought I to do with my life? It's the more elemental and demanding, who am I? What is my nature? What happens is when we go out and we get our job, we pick an organization we know is doing good things in the world, like Mondragon, we sign up, we start going through it. It starts to become a part of our identity. It's our work, right? I can remember sitting in a group like this. It was a small group. People that we didn't know each other. We did a round of introductions and they asked us just to introduce ourselves. Who are you? Every single man in the room told us who they were by telling us what they did. This is where I work. Hi, my name's Jeremy. I work at Regen, a plastic recycler, right? That starts to become a part of our identity. Here's the problem. If it is the core of our identity, it's not our vocation. It's becoming something else. Our vocation does not start with what we do. That is definitely a part of it. But what we do needs to be informed by who we are at our core. It starts by knowing ourself. And when we understand who we are fully, then we can take that out into the world to serve people and the organizations that we work with. Honestly, as I've sat and walked with people as a pastor, as I've studied and just kind of paid attention to the human condition, I think this understanding of vocation, it rings true for people, but it's a bit of a journey. This doesn't just happen. So younger college kids, I want to pay attention to this, but also know, it'd be interesting to hear what you think about this later. So, because there's some parts that I think I want you guys to do. I want you to know you need to go out and work for these organizations, like, and work at that. I'm not trying to say don't do that. So hear me saying that, all right? But anyway, I want to back up here. Our vocational journey starts as a child. And here's what I mean by that. How many of you, when you saw your kids, knew immediately, like before they could talk, my kids are different. They are not the same. Any of you have that experience? They're all laughing because you know it's true. Here's the deal. We come into this world as a beloved child of God. And we are all, every single one of us, unique individuals. When God created us, he said it was good. And he said, here's Jeremy Hsu. There is no one else like you. You have all kinds of gifts and abilities and all kinds of faults and foibles. All of it. That's you. That is all in us when we are a child, okay? That's the first step, knowing that we are these unique individuals. But then something starts to happen as we grow up. We get into training. This is our parents starting to tell us what's right from wrong, the right way to do things, the right clothes to wear, how to talk, what we do as a family. Then we start going to school and we start hearing all the same thing. We start going to church and our pastors start telling us the way we're supposed to behave and they tell us about God and what's right, what's wrong, don't do this, do this. You know, if we're honest, we learn like what jobs are acceptable and what ones aren't. Like, I mean, I grew up in a church. I remember my parents like kind of discouraging me from being a lawyer. I don't know why. It was just in our church, I just looked down on lawyers. But anyway, we learn all of these things. And so then by the time when we get to college, as we start, we know a little bit about ourselves, right? Like we know what we like. We know kind of what we're interested in. We know what we're better at than some of our friends. And so when we start pairing all the things that we've learned in all our various trainings, plus what we know about ourselves at the time, we start to then look for a job that's going to fit that. Because we hear about vocation in college. Like, we know it's got to be both us, what we like, or it's not going to be a job that we like. And so we want to be, like, make a difference in the world. So we look for those positions. So we go out to our outward service and to our occupation. And we start to live our life, and we do all these things. Really, honestly, probably focused on the outward call. Right? We think about it. What are we doing? And then inevitably, as we go through life, something's going to happen. We will hit a crisis of some point. If you're lucky, your crisis will just be the midlife crisis. We laugh, but I kind of think every single human actually goes through this. And what it is you wake up and you look at yourself and you say, man, I've been doing the same job for 35 years. Like, what am I doing with my life? Like, I don't even like this, right? I mean, and we get stuck there. I mean, sometimes a crisis is something horrible, like the loss of somebody. Maybe you get a cancer diagnosis. Maybe something just terrible comes along and it forces you to completely reevaluate, and you start to ask the question, this is the second poll, who am I and what am I about? And you completely reshift what your priorities are, right? I mean, we've heard people do this, people with near-death experiences, whatever, it happens. We come to these crises, and when this happens, we have a chance to make a decision. We can either double down and stay focused on the outward call, because we all know we're supposed to do that, and it's true. It is a huge part of what our calling is, what our vocation is how we engage in the world. We can say, I can just muscle through, I can just get through it. Or we can do the really hard work of starting to understand who we are. And that's what opens the door for us to start to have a full understanding of who God created us for, and what our purpose, what our calling, what our vocation is, and how we engage in this world. Because remember, it's not just our occupation. It's understanding who God made us to be. And once we have a deep understanding of that, it really doesn't matter what job you're in. You can learn to engage in that job in the way that God made you to do it, with that love that we were talking about, with the, like the interpersonal relationships, right? So it comes down to knowing ourselves as the other part of the pole. And if we make that hard decision and start to do that hard inner work of understanding that, what happens then is it changes how we engage in our outer work, and then it come back and it becomes into this cycle. And it becomes this beautiful thing of continuing the journey of growing into the person that God is calling us to be. That's what our vocation is about. So how do we actually go about doing this? Number one, it's kind of laugh, but I think we have to start by remembering our childhood. Remember how we came into this world with unique gifts and abilities? Every baby is different. We start seeing that as parents right away. We have to try to remember what we were like before all of our training changed us, right? I mean, how many of you are doing the dream job that you thought you could do when you were a kid? Probably none of us, right? Why? Probably because it didn't actually make any money, wasn't possible, whatever reason. And so all of these things pile up, right? And so we make these decisions that take us away from who we actually know God made us to be, and we don't utilize all of the gifts. Like, maybe you were a fantastic artist and your parents were like, do you want to be a starving artist or not? Right? And so you leave it behind, you make a decision, and then you've cut off this part of yourself that is actually part of God's gift of you for the world. And you're missing it because you're not following it. You're not paying attention. I don't know what it is for you, but this is the first step. Pay attention to that. And if you can't remember your early childhood and you still are fortunate enough to have parents around, go ask them, Mom, Dad, what was I like as a kid? What did I like? I asked my parents that recently, and they told me. They said, Jeremy, well, and the reason I asked them was because when I left ministry for business the first time, I was terrified of what, honestly, my uncle, who was the pastor that had kind of helped call me into business, I was terrified of what he would think. And so when I told him what I was doing, he just smiled and he said, Jeremy, I've known since you were little that business has been a part of you. It's been a part of the way you think and the way you see the world. There's just no denying that. It's like, absolutely, it's who you are. So when I asked my parents, my mom said, you know, that's true. She said, when you were little, one of the things you used to do is you draw pictures, and then you go to the neighbor's house and you knock on the door and you say, would you like a picture? And of course, the old women that were at home during work hours were like, yes, it's lovely. And I'd say, that would be $1. Okay, The other piece of us that we have to understand after we start to remember our childhoods, we also have to own our limitations and our shortcomings, right? Here's the deal. Our limitations and our shortcomings are as much a part of us as our gifts and our abilities. The problem happens when we're in leadership, when we deny what our limitations are. We can't forget that the whole purpose of the story of the incarnation, of God coming into the human form, was the limitless choosing to be bound by time and space in the human body. It's a part of our lived experience that we have limits. If we deny those, what happens is we get ourselves into trouble. We think we can do more. We think we are strong enough to get through it. We think we're the ones, our egos get in the way. Like, we're the ones who have to make the decisions because we're the smart one. We can do it. I mean, just look at all of the leaders that have failed or fallen drastically. And the problem is, in organizations, if we're the one at the top and we have this problem by not recognizing our own shortcomings, it's not just us that's going down. We take a whole lot of people with us. It hurts ourselves, it hurts our families, it hurts our relationships, hurts our employees, and it spreads out major. We have to do the hard work of understanding our limitations and our shortcomings. And one of the ways that we do that is we ask for hard feedback. There's an organization in Salt Lake City that's called The Other Side. Go look it up. It's a nonprofit, and what it is, it's a house of former convicts and addicts. They live together in community, they run businesses together, and they're completely self-governed. They do this all on their own. And they've been successful for years with people come out of jail. It's kind of a reentry program. And the way that they do it comes down to one of their, I don't know what it's called. They call it the games. It's a program, the games. And what they do a couple times a month, they'll have an evening where everybody sits in a circle. And if it's your time to do the game, you sit in the middle. And then you can't talk. And everybody else can. And what they're supposed to do is to tell you how you screwed up. What you did to them to hurt them, how you didn't do what you said you were going to do at work, how you, whatever. They can just unload. Now, I mean, think about this. Former convicts, addicts, like, it seems like this is going to go ugly, right? But it doesn't. And the reason it doesn't is because the ones who have been there longer and have done it have learned that there's usually some truth in it. When the people are saying these things, yeah, it's painful. But the reason it's painful, honestly, is because we know it's true. And we thought we were hiding it, but everybody else can actually see it. And what happens is, as I was reading about this, one of the participants said, the night after every game, you go to your bed and you lay down. You probably don't sleep that night. And what you do is you just roll through everything that they said, and you have to search for the grain of truth. Because they're not lying. It was their experience of you that day or whatever that week was. And when you find that grain of truth and you own it as your shortcoming, that's when you can do something about it. That's when you can grow. If you deny it, you're going to do it again because it's not there and you just try to avoid it. So the challenge to you all is if you want to continue this vocational journey and understanding who you are, ask for challenging feedback, and don't fall off the front of the stage. Ask people and listen and seek through, look for that grain of truth and use that to understand. And here's the beautiful thing. Number three is knowing whose you are to understand this. And the beautiful thing about that is that the God who created us with our gifts and created us with our foibles and still loves us the way that we are. This is what grace actually is, right? If we think that we have to force ourselves to change, what we are doing is we're actually forgetting the inner work and we're making that growth part of our outer work. We're turning it into something that we have to do out there so that we look like we're doing the right thing. That's not what grace is. Grace is undeserved. While we were yet sinners, while we were still broken is when Jesus came for us. So our work to understand our vocation has to do the hard work of understanding all of our gifts and all of our foibles. and learning to love ourselves the way that God loves us. And then in turn, that vocation can help us flow out into the world and love everybody that we're in contact with in our little areas of influence, in our organizations, in our families, and in our communities. And my prayer for all of us as leaders tonight is that we would be able to find our deep vocation, that we would understand that God is calling each of us to be the people that he created us to be, uniquely ourselves, not like somebody else, that we would find ways to run our organizations the way that God would want us to run them, not like how everybody else is doing it. And that ultimately we would know that every single one of us and everybody that we meet is a beloved child of God. Amen.